Trigger warning, rape, gender-based violence, and sexual violence. Hello and welcome to yet another episode of Intersectional Feminism Desi Style, brought to you by Feminism in India. We are your hosts. I'm Pragya.
And I'm Nishtha.
And I'm not going to wish you a Happy New Year because I do not want to jinx 2021, okay? Anyway, moving on. Today, we are going to talk about our jobs. Does that sound boring? Nahin yaar, itna boring nahin hai. Nishtha, please tell our listeners what I mean.
Okay, so this episode, I am very, 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 very excited about because we are talking about two things that are very close to our hearts, mine and Pragya's, which is gender and media. Now, because we work for an organization called Feminism in India, gender in media is something that we encounter many, many times. Things like trolling, things like mansplaining, people coming to us and telling us that jis article pe humne itna research kiya hai, we actually don't really know what we're talking about. So I think that's something that any woman who's working or any gender minority who's working in media has faced, had to face, and it comes with its whole other set of challenges, and that's something we are going to be talking about today with a very, very special guest. Pragya, do you want to introduce our guest for today?
To tell us more about how people who are working in this media space confront everything that Nishtha just said, trolls, as well as in general how they work, we have with us Japleen Pasricha, aka the founder, CEO, and editor-in-chief of Feminism in India, basically our boss. And Japleen smashes patriarchy for a living. She identifies herself as a water baby, that is, she loves swimming. Along with that, she also likes cycling, hiking, and gardening. She's a TEDx speaker and was recognized as a young innovator in 2018 by World Summit Awards. Her work on gender and media has been recognized by various international organizations such as the German Ministry for Economic Cooperation and Development and the Swedish Foreign Ministry. Apart from these, she has worked and supervised multiple campaigns on violence against women, gender-based violence in media, and many more such feminist campaigns with her teammates at FII. Welcome, Japleen. Tell us, how do you feel? Are you excited?
Hi, Pragya and Nishtha. Thank you so much for inviting me to my own organization's podcast. I am really, really honored that I got a space in this 12-episode series. So thanks a lot for that. And well, I breathe feminist media. That's what I do on my toilet pot, in my dreams, on holidays. Basically, I don't have a life beyond that. And that's great. So that's what we're going to talk about today.
Thank you so much, Japleen, for coming. Japleen has no time ever, so we had to like schedule this call so much in advance because we knew Japleen to busy hogi. So thank you firstly, Japleen, for taking the time out and coming. Japleen, let's go like right to the start. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about your work that you do? And more importantly, like, why did you choose digital media as the medium to contribute to the feminist movement? What prompted you to pick the internet?
Yes, this is a very interesting question that I have been asked since years, and I honestly never, you know, it never fails to excite me to answer this question because I'm always very excited to tell people that I am not a journalist. I don't have any training in media, professional training. I didn't even study gender studies, and I am literally just doing whatever I think I'm doing is right. Okay, no, I'm not that useless. But yes, my academic background is completely different from what I'm doing right now. I studied German language and literature and translation. I have three degrees in German studies, and I was supposed to become a German lecturer and professor and so on and so forth. And well, as you can see, after 3 degrees and, you know, 7 years, I wasn't very happy with what I was doing. And I've always had a very keen interest in gender and women's movement and women's history, especially women's rights. And media was something I think that came very naturally. I don't think I thought that, okay, one day I'm going to start a media, you know, startup, or I'm going to become a media entrepreneur. or journalist. I don't call myself a journalist because I feel like that's not who I am, but definitely a media person or a woman who works in media. And it just happened. Like, I'm sorry, this sounds like a love story. This love story is better than my actual love story. But anyway, yeah, it just happened. And I used to blog, and I think this is also the time when new media was coming up and young people like me, and sorry, I'm now no longer young, but like when I was in my early 20s, at that time, people were, exploring new media. We saw the boom of social media apps, and we saw boom of blogging and, sites like Twitter, Facebook, WordPress, where people were starting to engage and express their thoughts. And that's how I was introduced to digital media, specifically new media, which digital media is, very unique mojo, if you may to call it, is that it's accessible. You don't need to have contacts, networks, a degree in journalism or to let's say publish a blog post or to publish a piece or to write about something. You can do that yourself. And I think that's the beauty that new media and digital media provides, which makes it accessible for anyone and everyone who wants to talk about critical issues that they feel are not being talked about enough in the mainstream media.
So you mentioned that you mentioned academia, and so I also but I also feel
I knew, Pragya, that's where you would focus on.
No, but I wanted to talk about how, say, even if you do academia or you do journalism, I think all of us in some or the other way engage with mass media, say, be it in the form of pop culture shows, movies, television, or news. It can be any of these things. But all of us since our childhood have had consumed some or the other form of media, and that has shaped the way we think about the world, that has shaped the way we talk about the world, that has shaped how we perceive the world in general. It has also, say, influenced the politics of the country sometimes and reproduced gender stereotypes and also shaped our ideas in general. There are so many movies out there which are so sexist, people watch that and consume it and think that they can actually apply those things in real life, and they do, and that perpetuates a lot of problems. So while most of these impact of mass media has almost always been overwhelmingly negative, do you think, Japleen, there are ways that we can change this trend and make media our feminist friend?
Well, so first, I definitely agree with you on how mass media, like all forms of media, media is such a broad word, and there's mass media, pop media, advertisements, films, etc., etc. So, we don't realize what kind of deep subconscious impact media has in our minds on how we perceive things, on how we look at something. Like, I remember when, in the 90s, which is when I was growing up, this advertisement of Complan, like a Complan girl, you're a Complan girl or you're a Complan boy, and it's the mom always, telling the child that if you want to grow, if you want to increase your height or you want to grow stronger, whatever, you have the Complan milk, right? Or when you see advertisements where people are buying houses or cars or jewelry, and then it's like always men. I want to give this example of I was in class 10th, I think I was 15 then. This is 2005, and I don't know if you both have heard of this gang rape case, of the Dhola Kuma gang rape case in New Delhi. And as a 15-year-old, the details that I still remember, and it's been more than 15 years now, is that the woman was from Northeast. She was out at 2 a.m. or in the wee hours of the night, and she was wearing short skirt or something, and she went out with a friend to have Maggi. And this is near South Campus area, where a lot of students who are not from Delhi come and live because it's closer to their college, and there is a lot of there is a concentration of a lot of Northeast students from there. And the way that this case was reported back in 2005, that a 15-year-old even then remembers that these are details that were highlighted. She was gang raped while on her way back at around 2 a.m. because she went out to eat Maggi with her friend. A group of men, pulled her in the car. They raped her in the moving car, and then they threw her out in front of the Motibagh Gurdwara. And this case was, you know, all over. This is way before the 2012 Delhi gang rape case. It was all over in the news. Everybody was talking about it. And the focus was so much on why did she have to go out at night, you know? And again, the stereotype of Northeast women as being easy or loose or, you know, readily available. The way that something is reported has such a deep impact on how you perceive the victim in question or the survivor in question and the perpetrator. And there is still no news. You know, before this podcast, because I wanted to cite this example, so I went back and I searched for some updates on this case, and it's been more than 15 years and they have still not arrested the accused. There were about 3 to 4 men in that car who gang raped her, and they still have not been able to arrest him. The question is always asked, what was she doing at night? Why did she go out? Why did she have to wear a short skirt? Why did she have to eat Maggie at 2 a.m. from her, you know, nearby stall or whatever? But not like, why were these men out? Who gave them access to the car? And who, you know, like, where is the accountability there? You know, as I was talking about, like, these small examples of how rape is reported or how we see advertisements and which reinforces gender stereotypes, especially for, you know, in young minds, there is always, you know, also a space to create counter narratives. And I think that's what feminist media is doing, especially with the advent of digital media and new media, which, as I said, is accessible. And that is the greatest part about it. Earlier, media was a monopoly of just the mainstream media platforms or platforms like, you know, legacy media like Times of India, Hindustan Times, Indian Express, etc., etc. But now we see that there are young people who are taking that stage, and case in point, me. But apart from me, also, there are so many young people who are taking center stage and not taking the, you know, yellow journalism of mainstream media at all.
You know, Jipli, in everything that you spoke about right now, there's so much that we can pick up on and so many things that we will be addressing through the course of this episode and that we do end up addressing as young working professionals in the media space. But I want to pick up on something that you spoke about just right now, which is how up until now the media space has been dominated by these sort of big powerhouses, right, where editorial decision making is often in the hands of a very homogeneous privileged group. People don't really have a lot of space for different narratives because, again, like you said, you can't start a TV channel or a newspaper if you want to put out what you want to say. I'm going to come back to what is really the crux of this entire podcast, which is understanding intersectionality, how different identities, marginalized, they really play out in any kind of arena that we're talking about. So this is like a recurring question in the podcast, which is, do you think that the digital media space is now slowly getting more intersectional? Do you see an improvement? And more so, because you did say that there is now more access, I'm going to tweak that question a little bit and ask you that, when do you think it'll be truly intersectional? Like, do you think now digital media is like giving a tougher competition to mainstream media houses?
So I definitely feel that digital media is more diverse. I'm not sure if I want to label them as intersectional, because I feel like that's a pretty big label. And I'm yet to analyze all platforms. But I would definitely say it's more diverse. And as I said, like, I feel like the main reason for this is that, first of all, it's young people who are leading the movement, if I were to call it a movement. Like, for example, I'll tell you, when I started FII back in 2014, and I was, you know, still a student, and I honestly had no idea what I was doing, right? There were a couple of other platforms that I, at that time, was following. So one of them is called Dalit Camera. Now, this is a platform which is a video-only platform and talks, they shoot, you know, anti-caste protests and profile anti-caste activists and Dalit people and lives of Dalit people, etc. So this is a platform that I have been following since I have started FII. And I know that they also started around the same time, right? And there are many such platforms. This is just one example. There was no Dalit Camera, let's say, 20 years back. We know our writer Anusha Mishra, who was also part of a previous episode, I guess, and she runs this platform called Revival Disability Magazine. And again, that's a new form of digital media where she is using Instagram, like talking about disability, not just from the point of view of access and discrimination and inspiration, but also love, sex, desire, and relationships. And those are also important topics to talk about. You can't just, you know, categorize a community of people only from look at these poor people, you know, they have lost, like they are unable to live full lives, etc. You know, from all of these examples, we can see that it's young people who are passionate about the issue that they themselves also feel very personally, you know, affected with. Like they are disabled or they are queer or they belong to a Dalit community or, you know, they are just a frustrated young woman who is very, very fed up with the discrimination and sexism around her.
And I wonder who you're talking about there.
Yeah, she's a very good friend of mine. You don't know her. Yeah, so like you can see, you know, from these few examples, the kind of passion that young people have brought to media and to mainstream media, and they have now created a place for themselves where you can't ignore them. You can't dismiss them as, oh, this is some random blog, because it's not. You know, people are following their platforms and people, other young people are actually inspired by them. They want to follow the content that these young media entrepreneurs, and I'm going to call all of them media entrepreneurs, are creating, because they have created a space that didn't exist. And all, honestly, the mainstream media didn't bother to explore that space.
You know, if I can just quickly jump in, because I this is something that is often a question that I ask myself as, again, somebody like who's a young working professional working in a smaller outfit is, you know, yes, there is a change, but are we reaching masses? Like, you know, I mean, I still question that sometimes where I'm like, yeah, we're putting out all of this content that's so relevant and is a different perspective from things. But do you sometimes wonder, and Pragya, like, feel free to jump in here, that we're like speaking in echo chambers? For instance, like, let's take a very small example, the coverage of the entire Riya Chakrabarty case, the Sushant Singh Rajput and Riya Chakrabarty case. There was so much content that was put out there that was saying that this coverage isn't correct, it's unfair, it's a media trial. And we would be working on content like that, and I'd go out and I'd speak to people, and they'd be like, the only kind of this thing that they would have was of like this, I mean, I don't want to name him, but like a male anchor screaming and giving his opinion. So what are your thoughts on that?
So definitely, I also agree to what you just said. And adding to that, I also feel like, you know, we work with so many feminist organizations in India, as well as globally. Some of them are working like us, like mostly online, and then some of them are working on both ground and online. But we, at the end of the day, also cannot completely ignore that the digital world is still a relatively privileged space with respect to, say, access to the internet, or even, say, the knowledge and skills that you require to use the internet effectively. So yeah, so my question would similarly again be like, so what do you think, Jibreen? What do you think, that how has the feminist movement actually been able to reach the masses, or are we just like talking within our own liberal feminist circles and like we're not being able to, say, reach other people who are, say, lesser privileged than us, or are not ready to listen to us?
No, I completely agree with what both of you are saying, and I understand that, you know, this is a very niche market and we tend to be in echo chambers and speaking to the already converted, etc., etc. This is something that professor told me, like we were discussing something and this was used as a metaphor, that the first layer is the one that you would always discover. Like the top layer is the one that you would always discover first. And only then can you actually go deeper. The feminist community or you know, the people who are active are more or less privileged people, or I would say like moderately privileged people. And that's true for actually anything. Because that's how you start. When you start, it's the top layer that you always have the first access to, and then you dive deeper. You know, there are many angles to it. The first one is this. The second is also that the internet in itself is a privileged space, right? Like how many people have access to internet? And I'm not just talking about of remote areas where there are network issues, but we also know our own countries clamp down on internet in so many areas. We know about, you know, Kashmir and states in Northeast, and where internet access has been removed because of the state. The state has done it intentionally. So the internet then obviously becomes a very, very privileged space. And we tend to go round and round in our own circles. But I also feel like, to just going back to that metaphor that my ample supervisor, you know, told me once, that if you want to dive deep into anything, you have to uncover the top layer first. And I think this is the first step that we are taking. I think it's a very slow process. I feel like we have a really, really long way to go. But I also see hope in what I do, because if I don't, then you people are first of all losing your jobs. And I'm going to just shut everything down and curl up in my blanket. So to avoid that, hope is where we can start. And, you know, start with what we are doing in our small circles, like even if we are making a small impact, because we are not the only people who are working to make the world change. It's a lot of people like us who are doing that. And I think that's where the strength lies, and that's where the hope lies, that there's so many of us who will do their own small acts to bring about a positive change. Sorry, I'm just going all inspirational right now. But yeah, okay. I hope that answered your question.
No, I think you're right. I think keeping up with hope and a little bit of inspiration never hurt anyone in this field, certainly not us. And you know, you're talking about hope, and you're talking about how we have to kind of think, and even though we know that there's still a long way to go towards like tangible change, hope is something that keeps us here, and hope is something that keeps bringing us back, which actually makes me think about the fact that, while, again, you had mentioned, Japleen, earlier that the internet is a double-edged sword. So now I want to talk about the other side of that sword. While it's providing a place to people to talk, we have also seen that the digital space can be very intimidating. And intimidating is one thing, but it can be violent and invasive. And that's a whole other ballgame. The fact that nobody can deny that there is now also, I almost would like to think of it as like a parallel internet that's, you know, operational right now, where people are just out there, hordes and hordes of people out there who are just spreading violence and hate. And I know that that's something that we have been accused of before, but this I'm talking about like mindless sort of, not a differing opinion, not a new perspective, just simple hate and simple violence. I know also because of knowing you personally, of course, now that you have confronted such cases when you're working for an organization like this one. I don't think any of us have not confronted cases of such trauma. But how do you then, Japleen, tackle them? Especially since you've been working in the digital space for so many years now, what are your go-tos to fight the trolls and to fight the sort of people who are just looking for ways to bring you down? And not just trolls, you've been doxxed, we've had memes made on us. What do you do? And also, as somebody who's now got experience in the space, what suggestion would you have for women and people from gender minority groups to tackle these kind of hurdles?
Honestly, Nishtha, I don't think I have a solution for trolling, because as you said, it's just the number is so huge. The amount of money that is pumped in this troll banks and, you know, troll companies, if I were to call them, it's just unimaginable. And it's honestly really, really difficult for a person to tackle or to fight back. And that's something that we have seen, especially since 2014, with, you know, the rise of Hindu right wing in India, how journalists and women journalists are targeted. I mean, I get trolled, but I think my trolling is nothing compared to what a Sheila Rashid or a Barkha Dutt or a Sagarika Ghosh, Rana Ayub, Neha Dixit, like so many of the journalists who face trolling, even death threats for the work that they have done. It's just really, really sad to what we have become as a country, as a nation, dealing with trolls. Okay, this is difficult. Yes, I have been doxxed multiple times. FI has been doxxed. You know, this is, it's a very painful experience, obviously. And the problem also comes at times with how social media platforms actually deal with it. Because I just want to talk about, I'm digressing a little, but I feel like this is also important to talk about. So doxing is a crime on paper, definitely. Just for anyone who doesn't know what doxing means, it means publishing your private information like your home address, mobile number, etc. On the internet without your consent. And it is a crime under the Indian law. Now, and also social media platforms consider it an offense and they can block your account or suspend your account or whatever if you dox somebody. Now, all of this sounds great, right? And people who dox you then should be penalized. But there are a lot of loopholes. And one of the biggest loopholes that is used against people is that there's a lot of publicly available information, which, you know, for example, can be tracked via your company name or via your license or via your Aadhaar card. Or if you got forsaken, you know, considered a marriage under the Special Marriage Act and they put out, you know, your information and your partner's information for a month on their notice board. And that includes everything, your home address, mobile number, etc. And recently a court in Kerala put it online. And people use this publicly, and I'm, you know, quoted in a podcast. I know people can't see me, but I still want to quote. So please imagine me with a very sarcastic face saying publicly available information. And this has been misused so many times. We have the case of, you know, a Muslim man's shop, I think, put to fire because they were able to shop or car, I don't remember, but because they were able to identify him via this publicly available information. I was doxxed because of, a sarcastic face, publicly available information, which was connected to my company. Unfortunately, you can't reappeal this. Why? Because it's publicly available information. They say, oh, you know, this is just usual paperwork and we need this information because it's important for whatever company records or marriage bureau records or whatever records, license records. But how trolls or, you know, I would say the right wing is using this to actually target people, to harass people, to you know, threaten them. It's very, very dangerous. And unfortunately, neither the government nor the social media platforms are actually realizing that they need to amend and understand that publicly available information can be used to harm someone. And that is what's happening in a lot of cases. You know, my case wasn't very severe. Somebody didn't turn up at my home, although they could because they had the address. But just imagine this in a case of an already marginalized person, of a journalist who has spoken against corporate or spoken against the state, and especially journalists in marginalized and conflict areas. Just imagine what this kind of information could do to them. In our country especially, we do not have data protection laws and we do not have laws that protect us from all the different kinds of crimes that can happen on the internet, and especially to people who are raising their voice against the state or corporate. And, you know, in a democracy, that's literally our job. That is media's job, to question the state. So because of this kind of environment where journalists are threatened and harassed for just doing their job, we are also seeing a decline in quality of journalism, where now we have yellow journalism, we have Godi media journalism, where, you know, they just parrot what the state wants to say, and actually not critically thinking, not being the fourth pillar of democracy that they should be.
Thank you so much, Jipleen, for sharing these anecdotes. I think I've heard about this story so many times, and every time you say it, it seems bizarre, but like it is so real. So obviously there are some of these obvious issues within the media space. One of the biggest ones is obviously like the one that Nishtha mentioned before, that we see a lot of these anchors screaming on any kind of primetime channel. And I would actually go ahead and name him. I mean, we see Arnab Goswami do that very, very often. But even in liberal media houses, you know, there is a problem of representation. And every time we switch on any of these mainstream media channels, we see this upper class cishet men talking about a lot of issues, even in, say, liberal media spaces. So what do you think, Jipleen? How can we as feminists intervene and not only amplify the voices of those who are marginalized, but also actually help them mobilize through these power structures and empower them to talk about themselves in first hand rather than depending on these cishet, upper class men to, you know, someday take their issues and bring it forward?
Completely agree, Pragya. The problem of representation is, forget about Godi media and right-wing media, even liberal media, is a huge, huge problem. We don't see enough women in media houses at senior positions. We don't see enough Dalit, Bahujan, Adivasi people from marginalized genders. And that is a problem of diversity and inclusion that we have across sectors. It's not just a media problem, it's everywhere. So the problem with our approach to diversity and inclusion is that it's always seen as an afterthought, and it's not something by design. Diversity should be by design and not as an afterthought. So it shouldn't be like, oh shit, we don't have a Dalit writer as part of our team, or we don't have enough women in our newsroom. But it needs to be in the design of the structure of your organization. You cannot think about that afterwards, because then it's more of a tokenistic, it's a token. And I don't want to name, but I want to give an example, because I was really, really inspired by this panel. So there is a media conference that happens in Delhi almost every year. And last year I visited this conference in 2019, and there was a panel which was on caste and media, and it talked about how there are so few Dalit and Bahujan and Adivasi journalists in Indian media, right? And panel had, you know, all the people in the panel were Dalit, Bahujan and Adivasi. However, and you know, this is where this will tell you that why it's a token and not something which was designed to be diverse. There was one Adivasi panelist in this panel, and he said that, you know, the panel's name was Caste and Media, and there was a report being launched on the same topic. And he said, why are Adivasis always combined with Dalits? Like, we are not the same, you know, we are not the same community. We are not the same thing. So why is, first of all, caste always equated to being Adivasi when it's not? So that was the first critique that I found really interesting, and also I learned from it. Secondly, the other panelists, they were all Dalit people. There were two Dalit women and one Dalit man. So they are not just Dalit people or anti-caste activists. They are actually professional journalists. But the most interesting part of here, and this is something that they called out in the panel, is that in this conference, they were only invited to one panel, which was this panel, which was on caste and media. And they were not invited, they were not asked to speak on any other panel, even though they are journalists. So, and they said that, why are we, you know, called Dalit journalists and not journalists? Like, why is our opinion not asked in any other panel? Why are we just invited this? And it was so great, because they talked about this while in the panel, and the host of the media conference was sitting right there, and they heard them, and it was amazing. Like, really, I was laughing, but I also, you know, it was just such a, that marginalized people have to do this out loud in front of everyone so that people hear them.
No, Jacqueline, this is, it's so interesting that you bring this up because we, like in an earlier episode of this podcast, we were speaking with Nidhi Goyal and she brought up the, like a very similar point where she said that there's always this one panel which is from the marginalized voices. It's almost like, you know, persons with disability can't have an opinion on economic policy. So I always crack up whenever I hear this because it's sad and it's satirical, but it's also so true and so relevant. Jacqueline, when you were actually talking about how one can have like inclusion needs to be a part of design, I was just thinking one way to achieve that really is a policy that we so firmly believe in of non-appropriation, especially when you're talking about and this is like valid for media houses also and media organizations in general, especially when you kind of see the kind of pop culture content that's coming out where you have these people who are saying ki, "Arey, hum to trans issues ko we are bringing to the fore," and you actually like you realize that no bro, you're making it much much worse. So I think non-appropriation, wouldn't you agree, would be like one way to go about it, like, something that you keep saying, nothing about us without us.
I swear people will be like, what is this self-promotional podcast? but okay. So yes, FII has a very strict non-appropriation editorial policy where we do not allow privileged people to talk about marginalized people's lived experiences. So if you are an upper caste person, you don't get to write about Dalit women's lived experiences. If you are a non-Muslim woman, you don't get to write about Muslim women's lived experiences, and so on and so forth. And we announced this policy almost 4.5 years back in 2016. And, you would be surprised to know how many people disagreed with this policy. And a lot of them actually belonged to what we now call as liberal media. They said that this is segregation, this is exclusion, that's not how you do reporting, that's not how you create media. You don't, categorize media into like only those can speak. And we were very clear that we are a feminist platform, we are not a news reporting platform, and we focus more on lived experiences, and we want them to be first person, first hand, where people are talking about their own communities. And it's not saying that they will only talk about their own community. See, that's where the difference lies. Like if you have a trans writer in your team and you're only expecting them to write about trans issues, but what Nidhi Goyal said, can they not talk about the economic policy of the country? Can they not, analyze the budget? Like, why not? Like, can they not talk about business? And this is the problem when we, categorize people into these very strict bottles where you can only talk about, like, women can only talk about rape, violence, domestic violence, and menstruation, periods, childbirth, motherhood, that's it. Sorry, but why can't I talk about investing? Why is that a man's cup of tea and not mine?
Honestly, Jacqueline, this entire, like, I feel like this whole conversation, I can already tell we're in recording phase, and I can already tell that it's going to be a long episode. But again, like, you get three women media people together, you can't expect this episode to be a short one. So just the last thing before we wrap up this entire episode, one thing that I've always wondered, and now I'm going back to the very first answer that you gave about how you read about rape being reported back when you were 15. And I think we've all had similar experiences of the kind of things that media houses focus on and how stories are, you never get to know about, like, say, the background of a rapist. Nobody cares about that because apparently that's irrelevant, wo to karke chala gaya type of this whole thing. And the onus then really falls on women, and this is a narrative that has constantly been pushed by media, even the kind of representations that you have of rape, right? Like the kind of stock images that people are using for rape. It's always like ek ladki, she's like sitting in a shadow and there's like a red hand and these like really violent triggering pictures which really kind of show you, this is a story about rape because this girl is like suddenly her life has come to an end. And that really has, I get so frustrated when I talk about this because this has pushed the entire narrative of the A, victim on women, victim blaming on women. What are your like thoughts on that?
Yes, Nishtha, I completely agree. There is, the way that rape is reported in Indian media is completely abysmal, and it again reinforces the stereotype that somehow rape is the survivor or the victim's fault. And we have seen such bad reportage in terms of, the kind of images that are used, as you said, like there's always this woman who's sitting in a corner with her hands on her over her face because she's ashamed and she doesn't want to show you her face. And there's this looming hand, or especially in cases of child sexual abuse, they will show a broken toy. And these images are so problematic, first of all, and also so triggering for rape survivors and rape victims who would actually would have to revisit their rape incident because of such triggering and victimizing images. The woman is always a abla nari. And coming to the reportage, we have seen how especially now that we live in the digital world where everything is about clicks and TRPs, and how headlines and titles are used to how headlines or titles are used for shock value so that people click on it and the website gets more and more hits and clicks and advertisements and so on. And they would put these gory details in the headline itself, or they would always like compare it to the 2012 gang rape case because it has become this rape case which is like the most heinous case, and now anything which is not as heinous as the 2012 gang rape case doesn't get that kind of media attention. And we have seen that in so many cases where they would put the actual details of the rape case in the headline itself so that people would click on it. And this is really, really, irresponsible reporting because first of all, it is creating this competition between rape cases and, which gets reported and which doesn't. And only again, if your rape case is very heinous, only then it will get that kind of media attention and like a regular rape case will not. It also makes this, again, subconscious impact in people's minds who are reading this news or watching, on the channel, of how somehow the rape becomes the victim, the woman's fault. Like, we would, even though it is illegal and journalists are not supposed to reveal the identity of the victim unless the victim or the next of kin has consented, but even then, there are so many hints to where the victim lives or works or what she was wearing or where she was, why she was out, with whom she was or what she was drinking. All of these details are completely irrelevant to the rape. Like, it's not because of these details that she was raped. She was raped because someone decided to rape her, because that person, the perpetrator, about whom we don't talk about at all, decided that they want to exert their power. And rape is not about sex. We all know that. And this, I think it's high time that mainstream media also realizes that rape has never been about sex. Rape is about asserting power over someone, over making them feel vulnerable and taking away their agency and autonomy. But the way that it is reported in media always show, like, there are also these kind of reports where they would say jilted lover, threw acid on her face because if she can't be mine, then she can't be anyone else. Now, first of all, what is this jilted lover? Like, why do we use that phrase in media? He was not a jilted lover. He just couldn't, take no for an answer. So you can say immature man or man child if you want to really, label them. But they are not a lover because they never loved them, or they never understood that she is not interested in him. FII created a media toolkit on gender-based violence in media and how mainstream media should report rape and gender-based violence. This toolkit is easily available on our website. So please, please go and check out. If you're a writer or a journalist, or if you work at any mainstream or non-mainstream media, this toolkit would be really useful for you. And apart from that, we also released 10 crowdsourced images, artwork, which you can use to when you're reporting or writing about gender-based violence or rape. These are completely free. As Nishtha and I pointed out earlier, we are so tired of those victimizing images where the woman is sitting in a corner, ashamed, and there's a looming hand over her, or a man hitting a woman, or, you know, those kind of images. We have created powerful images, images that show women's strength and resilience, and we want mainstream media to use it when they're talking about rape, gender-based violence, sexual violence, domestic violence, or any kind of violence against women. Many news platforms have already started using it. We have seen it on Scroll, Wire, Caravan, EPW, Indian Express, Deccan Herald. As I said, it's free, so please feel free to download them, use them, just give us a credit line, and that's all we need. Thank you. And sorry for that self-promotion.
I'm glad, Jipleen, that you mentioned that, you know, there are ways to negotiate with space of privilege. And in this case, obviously, we're talking about the media circles. And a lot of people from the marginalized communities are also actively doing it, despite having to face a backlash or trolls. And yes, and like you mentioned before, hope is where we can start. Hope is actually one of the most basic feminist ethics, at least I believe that. And that absolutely inspires us. At least I could talk about on my behalf and say our team that, you know, to continue fighting, not only say for ourselves or our own groups, but also beyond us. I recently also have become someone who prioritizes the community over the individual. And just like you, Jipleen, I too believe that if we are all not healing together, then we are not actually healing. So yeah, so I'm going to let Nishtha take over on that note and hope that she also agrees with me, I guess.
I do. When do I ever disagree with you? No, okay. But, because Jipleen is so worried about self-promotion, she's going to kill me when I do this. I'm going to get yelled at, and I'm going to do it anyway. I'm very, very, very excited today to announce that FII is launching a membership program. And I'm so glad that we get to announce it on this episode specifically, because I feel like this isn't now when I say this, it isn't just a plug. It isn't just talking about, you know, ki ha, au, we are so great. It's also relevant to what we're talking about, right? With everything that Jipleen mentioned and we spoke about in this conversation, with how it is becoming difficult to create alternative media. There are a lot of hurdles that are in our way. We're still trying. But again, we're not funded by big corporates, because one of the tenets of FII is to make feminist content accessible, and that's something that we want to continue doing. So please consider becoming a member. There's like benefits and resources and a lot of things that you will be getting access to. But for me personally, the biggest thing would be that you'd be supporting an independent media organization that's working very hard to bring you unbiased news and to make itself stand out among what is honestly a lot of white noise. So do consider becoming a member of the FII family. We're very excited to have you here. And once again, thank you, Jipleen, so much for being with us on today's show.
Thank you so much. I really, really enjoyed it. I hope I get invited to more. Just kidding.
That brings us to the end of this episode of Intersectional Feminism Desi Style. Like always, thanks so much for tuning in. Next Thursday, we're going to be talking about sexual and reproductive health. Hush, hush. But we're not going to be so hush, hush about it. So please do join us for that episode. And once again, thanks for tuning in.